Welcome to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. This podcast is for those who are committed to thriving no matter where they are in that journey. And I say journey because thriving is not about achievement. It is not a destination. It is about engagement. When we feel energized by our life and we feel at our very best. My name is Bobby Kaler and I'm your host. And I'm so excited to be on this journey with you. I mentioned that it's a journey and you might find yourself anywhere along that path. You may be starting out. You may be moving up within an organization. You might be an entrepreneur, a business owner, a salesperson, or self-employed. Or you just might be that person who feels like there's something calling to you and it's time for a change. My mission is to provide stories that inspire us so that when the specter of doubt darkens our doorway, and it always shows up at the absolute worst time, we will choose to persist. I will also provide practical skills, perspectives, and ideas that will help us create the habits of thriving and flourishing. This is about providing hope, knowledge, and assurance that we can all be more fulfilled and successful if we choose. Let's get right to today's episode. I am so excited to have this guest on my show. He was in Tower 1 on the 81st floor on the morning of 9/11. His actions that day led him to be in People Magazine and on Good Morning America and the Oprah Winfrey Show. There was also an amazing documentary on the History Channel detailing his story. He is also a colleague of mine and a very dear friend. His name is John Sequeira, and I can't wait for you to meet him. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I was thinking about this because when I was launching the podcast, I thought, who do I want as a guest? And your name came up pretty quickly on my list. And then I was thinking about how long has it been since we first met, which I think was 2010 in Ogden, Utah.
Wow. Yeah, that's a long time ago. That was for we're allowed to say the company. We'll see what we say about the project. You can hit the edit button. But yeah, it was a food manufacturer distribution company. And so a lot of household names. And yes, you were running a workshop for manager development that I had sold. And that was the first time we met in Ogden. Yeah, gosh, that's crazy.
And one of the things I remember about it, and I don't know if you will, we got there at different times. You were getting there late. I got there early in the day. Yep. So our travel agent, she said, well, Bobby, since John's getting there late, I'm going to let him get the car. And she told you the opposite. So the next day we're walking out in the parking lot, ready to go to the client. And we're walking through the parking lot and you're like, where's the car? And I'm like, what do you mean? I didn't get a car. So we were hitchhiking to the client. It was impressive.
Well, you may have a greater kind of sense of control or planning associated with your trips, which makes that much more kind of crystallize in your mind. Most of my trips are kind of like, I'll figure it out when I get there. So that does not even register. I don't even remember that. Melissa, my wife, gets frustrated with me because she'll ask when I go on trips, well, where are you going? Where are you staying? When will you get there? And I'm like, look, I'm going to Austin, Texas. She's like, great. Where are you staying? I'm like, I don't know. I'll look that up on the phone when I get there. How are you getting there? I don't know, but
I don't know.
There's going to be a way to do it. So I don't remember that. What I do remember is the first time you made me cry in a workshop. That's what I remember. So what the emotional connection, right? You forget what is it? You forget what people do. You remember how they make you feel.
Yeah.
And yeah, I remember that. You were telling a story and you have a couple of stories that you include in development about being an other-centered leader. And one story was about your mom and like persevering with your speech impediment early on in youth. And then the other one I remember was about your boss when you were running a fast food restaurant and you didn't have a phone and he knew you were a daddy's girl and you had done such a tremendous job with some influx. There was some event in the small town in which this restaurant was located. And you did such a good job that your boss brought you in the office and said, hey, I want you to talk to your dad, or picked up the phone and called your dad and said, hey, your daughter's just done a tremendous job. And I just want to give you some time to talk to her. And like both of those stories I'm just blubbering. We're trying to train people how to sell more and coach more. And I'm over here just like, I want to call my parents and just cry over it.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. You remember those stories well.
They're so powerful, and your story is so incredible. And I love it. It's inspiring. It inspires me to look at stories from my background that help people emote in that same way. And not just, you know, driving emotion for the sake of emotion, but getting an emotional engagement that leaves the door open for practical application, practical help. That's scenario based, and you just do a phenomenal job with that. So that's what I remember. But yeah, fine. We didn't know a rental car. That's my every other day where I don't know how I'm going, where I'm going. Yeah.
Well, you know, and you're talking about my story, which thank you very much. You have a truly amazing story. And this is always something I didn't understand, because I always thought we were friends. But it was 2 years later when I finally learned about your story. And that came out because we were in Dayton, Ohio. Different client.
Yeah,
Yeah, I was facilitating the workshop. We were doing introductions, and I had said, "Oh yeah, and in your introduction, you know, tell us something that we don't know about you." And you said, "Well, if you really knew me, you'd know that Oprah Winfrey once touched my knee." And I was like, "Oh, there's a story there," and that's when I learned your story. So, do you want to share about your story?
Sure, of course. So. The way I was on Oprah, how I got to Oprah was I was present during the September 11th terrorist attacks in New York. So I graduated from undergrad in May of 2001 from NC State University, moved up to New York in June 2001, and my office was on the 81st floor of Tower 1 of the World Trade Center. And so on the morning of September 11th, I was there with thousands of other people. And when the plane hit the building, my boss and I headed to the stairwells to evacuate. And on the way down, we happened upon a woman who was a wheelchair user on the 68th floor. And we helped her escape. And the three of us, you know, got out of the building about 5 minutes before our building collapsed. And because of the fact that this woman was not known to us earlier on, she worked for another company. It was actually the Port Authority of New York. We actually, in all the chaos, never got her name. And so when we put her in an ambulance and the ambulance sped away, and then, you know, a few minutes afterwards, our building collapsed virtually on top of us. We didn't know how to determine whether the woman who we had helped was able to escape alive. And so when reporters were asking us all these questions and what had happened, and they could tell obviously we were part of the event because we were covered in dust and debris, and really our goal of talking to them was to see if they could help us, you know, find out who this woman was and if she had made it out alive. And so that began this kind of media wildfire effort. And so we were in USA Today the next morning. We were on People Magazine the next week. We were on Good Morning America a couple weeks after that, and then on Oprah. And so that's usually instead of giving the full-on background, the, hey, tell me what there is to know about you that most people don't know or most people might not know. And the Oprah thing is just the most succinct way to get people to, I don't know, pay attention. It's definitely one that spurs some conversation in some of those icebreaker type environments.
Yeah. Well, it got everyone's attention. And anyone who hears your story, they always remember it. I remember too, you were on the History Channel. They did a profile. Mm-hmm. And didn't you stop at some point? And didn't you call your dad as you guys were descending?
Yeah, sure did. So I tried to call him a couple times. One, when the plane first hit the building, this is before anyone knew it was a terrorist attack. You know, it seemed to be an isolated incident. And I was trying to call him in an office that was set up as the fire marshal designated area for people to gather. And so I tried to call him there, was not able to get through. But then, you know, I would say halfway down our descent, probably somewhere in the 40s or 50s of the building, there was an area that was kind of set up as a triage area for people who were injured or needed just otherwise medical attention. And so I got off and called him there. And it was an interesting conversation, you know, where we're now looking back at it. He knew what was going on because he was watching the news from you know, at home in North Carolina. And so he knew how grave the situation was. I didn't, and he nor did he tell me. He just told me to get out. He asked me where I was. I told him I was a little lower in the building than I actually was, so that he wouldn't worry. And then to not make me worry, he said, okay, great. Yep, it's dangerous. We see the news. Get out. Get off the phone right now. Stop talking to me and just leave the building. And so, yeah, it was wild when I look back at where I was and what the world was seeing at the time when I was speaking to him.
Yeah. Had to be hard for him at that point to know that you were in such danger.
I cannot imagine. No. As now as a parent to feel so helpless and to be so informed about what was going on generally, but so uninformed, you know, as to my whereabouts, my safety, I cannot imagine. And it's been hard. I mean, it's something that both my parents, my mom in particular, you know, still struggles with today.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause I mean, and there's nothing they could have done to help. Now, I remember when we were first talking about this years ago, and I asked you, because you were what, 22, right out of college,
yeah,
on the 68th floor. You see this woman who's a stranger, you don't know her. And I remember asking you at the time, what made you stop to help?
Yeah, what made us stop to help? You know, the way we happened upon her was that my boss, his name is Mike, we had moved from the 81st floor to the 67th floor pretty rapidly. And we only knew that our stairwell was available because a fire marshal told us that it was. But as we started getting further down the stairs, we realized that not everybody in the floors below us, as we were passing them, knew how to get out. And so on the 67th floor, we heard people, you know, in the hallways above us, trying to figure out how to get out. And so we thought, well, you know, we have time, or we know the answer, and there are people who need this answer. So we went back up to go guide them. And so it just became this effort of, we're trying to accomplish this goal of making sure people in these hallways know how to get out. And, you know, at first we started guiding people who were closest to the door, to the stairwell. Then they would tell us whether there's people in the hallway, you know, halfway down, you know, on the other side of the building. So we went there, and then we happened upon an office, which is where this woman was working. And she was there with all of her other coworkers. And we were just so shocked at the fact that we would see a group of people who at the time were just standing there, and yeah, unbeknownst to us, they were just standing around because they were kind of blocking the view of this woman. So we didn't know what they were doing. And then when we started yelling at them to get out, we realized why they were delayed, why they were stopping, because they were trying to figure it out. And so, you know, what made us help? I think it was just really the momentum of, we had a goal to get people towards the stairwell. And then when we found out that there was someone, you know, for whom getting there and getting down would be a barrier, it just became kind of a natural progression of, you know, hey, do you mind if we help?
Yeah, that's amazing. It's amazing you went back up. I think a lot of people would have just been concerned about, how do I get out?
Yeah, there was some of that. And, you know, similar to some of these pieces, you know, this does not make for good podcasting or television or radio. But, you know, I know that there's this effort to paint this picture of, you know, this divine intervention. And we were just so, you know, we were so inspired that we just decided to help everybody against all odds. But to be real and to be very human about it, we didn't know the gravity of the scenario. And so, nor did we, you know, like anybody else, have any idea of, you know, the timeline within we were working, right? We didn't know that, right, it was at that time probably 45 minutes before the floor we were standing on would not be there anymore. And so, you know, it's interesting. I like to put that in a context, you know, because some of these stories will have, you know, the heroes from 9/11 and put us in that category. And it's a little embarrassing, you know, if I'm not able to give some context of, hey, there was an explosion, there was a fire, we didn't know the building was collapsing, and we were just trying to do what was human in nature. And then when I tell that story, other people say, well, even that's great. And so who knows?
Can't get away from people saying it was great.
I guess. I think it's just that I was a 22-year-old dummy who likes to do a lot of things that other 22-year-olds like to do, and go out and go to bars and talk to girls and hang out with my friends. And it's just the juxtaposition between what I thought my life was and then being thrown into this global event is just still, you know, almost 20 years later, mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. I can't even imagine, John, you said it, you're 22. Just how did it change you?
Yeah. I mean, it changed me a ton. So initially the goal alignment or my priority alignment just shifted immediately. So the day before, you know, September 10th, my greatest concern was moving into a cool apartment with a few coworkers so that we could be as close to the bars that we like to go to as possible. And I had purchased a leather jacket in Soho that when I got it home, I couldn't determine if it was black like I intended or a very, very dark brown. And I was racking my brain on whether it was black or brown. That's the like most, you know, complete picture of where my priorities were on September 10th.
That was your big problem,
that
right?
Was it. Biggest problem I had that in my purview on my windshield was, do I have to go back and try to return this jacket because I want it to be black and not just very, very dark brown? And so that was those were my priorities on September 10th. September 11th, all I wanted to do was see my family, my loved ones, you know, just really step back and live life with intention, born out of the reality that you know, life is not infinite. Our life on this earth is not infinite. And so my priorities shifted as far as, you know, relationships became a much bigger part of what drove me. So that was a big deal. That was initially, you know, beyond that, when I look back at the event and what happened and how, you know, we were used, my boss and I were used to actually do something good for somebody else, you know, and then how that story became helpful to other people who were trying to just grappling with what the world meant for them and how to make sense of this senseless act in this new environment that was super unfamiliar to everybody. I really started gravitating towards this idea that Aslan, where we know each other from, really hits home, is that we are most fulfilled when we serve others.
Yeah.
And that really became a guiding principle then. And it's my guiding principle now. It's, you know, when I look at what my priorities were, leather jackets, apartments, career in Manhattan. And those were methods of trying to find what I thought would bring fulfillment. What would make me happy? What would make me feel productive? And then to shift that to looking at how the impact of doing something that was not in my best interest, it was actually, you know, counterproductive to my best interests, and how that has enriched my life and even the lives of others, that's really what's changed for me is that becoming kind of my guiding principle of how I conduct my life in general and the guiding principle of what I like to do on a day-to-day basis.
Yep. And there's something really powerful about that too. You know, what did you learn about moving through adversity through this experience?
Yeah, a few things. And gosh, it's particularly poignant, you know, now, the environment in which we live, where we have COVID-19 and not just the safety concerns of that, but the economic impact. You know, we have racial injustice that's just making everybody, you know, reevaluate how we go about our day to day. And it's just, it can be super overwhelming. And so there are some pretty stark parallels to 9/11 and what's going on today, in at least just in terms of, hey, the world you thought you were living in and your playbook for how to operate within that world doesn't work anymore. And so we've got to start reevaluating and coming up with some ways to move forward. And so, you know, I look back at how I adjusted then and what I'm using now for kind of the adjustment we all have to go through. And it really lives in a few different areas. Number one, it's definitely helpful to have some belief, some faith in a higher power. So we've got the higher power piece. Then it's helpful to look at, practically speaking, using some frameworks that I know you and I have both been familiar with, things like Maslow's hierarchy, seven stages of grief, and then going into the we're most fulfilled when we serve others. Those really four key elements helped me then, and it helps me now. And so when I look back at the first piece, the faith principle, my faith is rooted in probably a more conventional Judeo-Christian set of ethics, right? I believe in a God. I believe in a conventional form of heaven. But man, even people who don't believe in that and just believe in things like the universe wanting balance and equilibrium, or just principles that there's a professor, Scott Galloway, he's at NYU, and he's a marketing professor, and he's just super insightful. But he maintains that nothing in life is as good as you think it is, and therefore nothing is as bad as you think it is. There's always kind of this central theme of there's going to be balance. And so whether you believe in your Judeo-Christian type ethics and religion, or you just believe in more agnostic or even kind of worldly principles, just a faith that everything's going to be generally okay is helpful, right? It just helps you build context that here and now is not all there is. And so that just helps build the context in, you know, I'm not going to be in the stairwell forever, but if I am, there's some greater purpose associated with it. Same thing to today. Hey, we're not going to have this global pandemic forever. This is a point in time. It seems intense, but things will move on. We'll figure out how to create some level of balance. And so that's helped me just from context. Beyond that, some helpful frameworks too that I use when things shift are, I really rely on things that I learned in, gosh, I think this was in my psychology class in high school. And I'm still friends with my teacher who's still teaching. His name is Dr. Steve Jones. He's amazing, but he taught me these frameworks, Maslow's hierarchy of needs and the stages of grief. At the time, there were seven. I think it's evolved from then. But Maslow's
hierarchy. It was a long time ago, John. Come on.
Oh, man. Yeah, we didn't even know all the stages of grief you could have back then in the 90s. Yeah. Maslow's hierarchy, just the idea that at a base level, we need our basic fundamental needs met. Your food, mm-hmm. your shelter, so on and so forth. Then the next level starts moving into respect and comfort and a sustained level of comfort. And at the pinnacle is what's known as self-actualization, right? That's the idea that, hey, once everything's pretty satisfied, how do we grow as human beings? And so when these events happen, when there's crises that emerge like this, I see it as an opportunity to just feel okay with moving further down that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And so I think a lot of us, like you and probably a lot of listeners of this podcast, consider ourselves to be high performing professionals, high performing kind of, you know, I don't know, human beings that would probably put us closer to that self-actualization level. But when we all face a crisis, it's okay to say, oh gosh, are the levels that are lower, that are more fundamental in that hierarchy of needs, are they even being met, right? Am I safe? Can I consider, can I rely upon some level of safety for a prolonged period? Or gosh, is, you know, what's my job look like? Am I financially secure? So it's okay to know that when things shift, you can go backwards and say, hey, are my fundamental needs met? And I hear a lot of people getting frustrated with, you know, gosh, I thought my sales number was going to be better this year. I thought revenue was going to be better. I thought my career was going to be at a greater trajectory, and I'm feeling stuck and I don't know how to navigate that. And I think if people just recognize that, hey, when things shift, it's okay to go back and figure out if fundamentals on which you relied upon, if they're taken care of first, and then you can build yourself back up. The other piece around the stages of grief starts with the denial, ends up with acceptance. There's a really good trajectory to follow when you're faced with a crisis that drives grief. I don't think a lot of people recognize that this, you know, COVID, and gosh, of course, the policing debates and protests associated with it, like, we're facing grief, some greater than others. And it's okay to realize that everybody, the human range of emotions, starts in this denial, and then multiple steps before you have acceptance and before things are better. And one of the steps that I think is particularly important to reconcile with or get comfortable with is there is a stage in those seven stages of grief that speaks to depression, right? There's a time where when you're going through grief, once you go through denial and your anger and your bargaining and the crisis really starts hitting home, there's a stage of depression. And I think it's important for people to recognize that that is a step in the process. It's not something that's wrong with you, right? That psychological conditions and mental health is starting to kind of relieve the weight of a stigma associated with it. But there are still people who kind of beat themselves up about not being able to buck up and being too depressed, not being able to snap out of it. And I think it's important for people to recognize that when there's a crisis, it's okay for some self-care to recognize that, you know, yeah, this sucks. And if you're going to be down about it, there's nothing wrong with you. It is a step in the process.
Right.
And so, you know, that's the step in the process that then ultimately lands on, well, what are you going to do about this? And I think that's where the tenet of we're most fulfilled when we serve others really comes into play. Because if you're going to get to that acceptance, the hope is that you're not getting that acceptance without changing your behavior, without figuring out how you're going to operate within kind of the new structure. And so the best way that I found to feel empowered, to be fulfilled, and ultimately to help drive change is to figure out, well, where can I serve? Where's a way that once my level of Maslow's hierarchy, once those levels are at a point where I can rely upon my safety, then where else can I help? And whether that's helping other people through those seven stages, whether it's helping somebody who is stuck at kind of a lower rung of a Maslow's hierarchy, right? Where they're not as safe, they're not as financially secure, they're not as comfortable with their career, as the policing debate rages on, how we as white allies can help our colleagues and our friends of color. It's just, what are we going to do once we realize that this is the new state of the world, or a state of the world that we've just become exposed to? And so that driving towards a level of fulfillment by serving others becomes the mechanism that kind of propels me forward, and I would argue would help propel other people forward as they're dealing with adversity or any type of crisis.
Yeah. What's the one thing I can do to serve?
Right.
And John, there's so much good stuff in there. When you were talking about the seven stages of grief, I remember this was, I think I was in college and I had a psychology professor and we were talking about it. And she said that most people, they have a tendency, they want to skip past the unpleasant emotions, you know, the anger, the depression, that type of thing. I read a book years ago. I have it somewhere on my bookshelf. It's called The Dance of Anger. And we're always taught, well, we should never feel anger. And what this person is saying is anger is an emotion. And it's a fine emotion. It's telling us that something's not right, perhaps. What's not okay is to lose your temper all over the place. You know, it's how we express it.
Right. Yeah. I think that, I mean, there's this idea that there are no wrong emotions.
Right. Right?
All emotions are valid. It's how they manifest themselves in your behavior is what, you know, what drives a level of self-control and ultimately is seen by others. And so that's where I just kind of look at those, you know, three big buckets. It's faith that there's something bigger than us. There's context that what we're going through is a point in time. Then some practical frameworks about, hey, are my needs being met? Are my basic needs being met? Am I at a place where I can help others, right? You can't pour from an empty cup. So
if
we're filled, then we can serve others. And then the seven stages of grief, I think really is, you hit it home, that all these emotions are valid. There is value in recognizing and valuing the unpleasantness that requires us to go through for growth. And then as far as what are we going to do, you know, going forward, how are we going to let that manifest itself in our behavior? The best methods are just looking at where I can serve. And there's ways to do that. But I think that's how I've made sense of what happened in 2001. And gosh, even in the 2008 recession, 2008, 2009, 2010, that was tough times. And now we're going through a series of crises now. And those are the tools in my toolbox that are at least helping me navigate.
Yeah. And there's a couple more I want to explore there, because I want to make sure that we come back to one too.
Please.
Before getting to that one though, on the seven stages, we don't have to judge whatever emotion we're feeling, right? It is what it is. So don't judge it.
Right.
And the other thing, and this is from someone else I learned, I think it was a coach years ago, but she said, whatever emotion that you resist will persist. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Don't keep it at bay. You know, live in it, live in the present. I love that. I mean, there's so many great experts in the field of mindfulness. And one of the big tenets of mindfulness is being present. There's all these different kind of competing beliefs about what meditation means. Meditation can mean put all your thoughts out of your mind. But then there are some people who say, well, I can't. So now that's actually making me more stressed out.
That's me. I get really stressed. I can't do this right.
Yeah, my meditation is stressing me out because I can't do it. And the balance, the experts or the philosophies that I find most comfort in or most practically appealing is mindfulness can just be an awareness of what's going on. You don't have to ignore what's going on. In fact, ignoring it might make it worse, but just feeling, hey, if I'm having a great day, I'm having a wonderful walk and the weather's phenomenal and the sun's out and I'm with my family, you know, it's good to stop and appreciate that as a feeling, like appreciate the good parts. But conversely, when I'm going through trying times and when you're down in the dumps or when you're frustrated or stressed, it's equally as valuable to stop and say, you know, I recognize what I'm feeling here and these feelings are valid and helpful and productive for me to feel. And so just the more you start leaning into recognizing and being mindful of what you're feeling, then no feelings are wildly bad, right? And no feelings are good. It's just a way to recognize and operate.
They're just data points.
They are. Yep.
You know, the other thing I wanted to talk about too, because I thought, John, I don't know if I've ever heard anybody talk about it this way. Maybe I wasn't paying attention in class. It's entirely possible.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. When you were talking about the hierarchy of needs and you said, mm-hmm. It's okay. I think there's always this pressure. We're always supposed to be moving up into that, you know, and you said, it's okay to let yourself maybe go back down a little bit to make sure you're covered. And it was just something that I don't know if I've ever heard anybody talk about it quite that way, but mm-hmm. Where does that come from for you?
Yeah. Great, great point. And to be clear, I am not an academic in this field at all, which by the way, I mean, that's okay. I'm very comfortable making claims that are not backed up by science at all, but no, I think it was the recognition, Bobby, that the Maslow's hierarchy, it was taught to me accurately or not. It always seemed like, hey, it is just this progression. I move from the bottom up and there's always one way. But then when I start looking at the trends in our lives, it's really interesting. There's a wonderful book. It's called The Happiness Curve. And it claims that our happiness dips as not just human beings, not just Americans, but across the world and in even the animal kingdom, your lifespan, your relative lifespan, you dip in kind of a level of happiness in what is now in our, you know, late in 40s, and you start getting out of it in your early 50s. That's a claim that this person's making. And there are multiple claims on the fact that kind of your happiness or your feeling of productivity or success undulates in life. And so when I map the undulations in your perception of your progress and your success and your fulfillment, and I look at the downswing in those undulations, that makes me look at Maslow's hierarchy and says, you know what? We're not just always moving up. When things change, when the ground shifts underneath us by a financial crisis, social unrest, political unrest, you know, a pandemic, we start moving downwards in our fulfillment and our success. And if we're going to move downwards in our feelings of fulfillment, it stands to reason in my mind that as we're moving up in Maslow's hierarchy, it's okay to say, hey, when the ground's shifting, is it okay for me to look and make sure that some of these fundamental elements that I thought were in place and on which I relied, you know, are they still there? And if they're not, like, I've got to go figure it out. Right. So that might just be my interpretation on how you can use a very valuable framework, not when you're just in a growth mindset, but when you're in a, you know, when you're in a defensive mindset.
Yeah. And I think it also gets to the piece around maybe self-care even, right? Mm-hmm. And that it's okay. And I think a lot of times in our society, we're just pushed to always go, you know, to keep going and pushing harder and harder. And sometimes it's okay to say, you know what, I need to make sure that my bases are covered.
I mean, how many stories do we hear about people who are at the pinnacle of what success might be defined in their world, whether it's an actor, an artist, someone who's a captain of industry, someone running a hedge fund, and they get to this level and they have a breakdown, right? Mm-hmm. They go to rehab or they burn out, or worse, they take their own lives. And so you've got these people moving upwards and they've identified what they believe are the markers of success. They achieve them, which again would put you at that higher, that pinnacle area of Maslow's hierarchy. But then meanwhile, their actual health, their fundamental safety, their well-being that lets them operate on a day-to-day basis is at risk. And so, you know, when you're facing that crisis, whether it's self-created, you know, perceived, or it's based on your external circumstances, you know, it's worthwhile to say, gosh, are those basic elements worthwhile? Because I can't build the third floor if the foundation of my house isn't sound.
That's right. And you can't, I learned this one the hard way when I got sick in 2003, you know, I spent however many months in bed, and it occurred to me, you know, it's really hard to serve anyone else when I can barely sit up. Like, right. I can't help people right now. And that was painful. Wow. Tons of good stuff there. So what are you up to today? Of course, I know the answer, but tell us what you're up to today.
What am I up to today? So my professional life is exclusively with Aslan Training and Development. So we're a sales training and management coaching firm. We work with large organizations that are trying to move their people in a more productive direction. Most often it's related to salespeople or customer service people who, if they change their behavior, they will be more successful themselves and the company will achieve their financial goals. And so that's what we're doing. You know, our path to getting there is starting with that foundational principle of we are most fulfilled when we serve others, not just because it's the path to being a good person, but the more we suppress our self-centered motives and help other people, the more rewarded we'll be. It's this paradox of the less I care about what I get out of serving, ultimately the more I get out of it. And mm-hmm. So I'm working with Aslan doing that for a handful of clients in multiple different industries. I'm also, you know, I'm a dad. I'm a husband and a dad of my wife of almost 11 years. No, it is actually 11 years, and my 8-year-old daughter. And so we're just trying to navigate. We're trying to navigate all the things that are facing us, right? How to deal with, you know, social distancing and running our respective jobs without traveling. You know, candidly, educating our daughter on what's going on with race relations and systemic racism, and then reaching out to, you know, people within our organization and outside of the organization to see, you know, where we can help, where we can help on that front. And so, that's what I've been doing, and then trying to have a little bit of fun in the meantime. It's getting warmer. It's nice out. And so seeing where we can salvage whatever summertime activities that are still available to us.
Yeah. And I know you love the water, right?
Love the water. Yeah. Love to be out. Sailing is a passion of mine. And so whenever I can be out on a boat, harnessing the wind and being out there is a good day for me.
Now, did you ever get the paddleboard? We talked about that at one point.
Heck yeah. Oh yeah. Paddleboard all the time. Yeah. Paddleboard all over the place. yeah, we're in Raleigh. So that's about 2 hours from the beach, but we have a few lakes here in town. And so that's really easy to just throw the paddleboard on the car and head out there. And when I feel like having the paddleboard as we're going, you know, 80 miles an hour down the highway, we throw it on and bring it down the beach.
And hope it doesn't fly off the back.
That's the hope. Oh yeah. There's been plenty of times where we pull off the highway. Cause I'm not, again, I don't purport to be an academic, an authority on quality subjects, nor do I purport to be someone who knows how to sufficiently secure anything about my car that will stay on 80. So we'll pull off on exits and have to fix that every once in a while.
Oh my goodness. Remind me, I never want to drive behind you.
You never do, but it might be slightly preferable to driving with me.
I've been in that boat too. So, right. So John, if someone wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way?
They can email me at johnc@aslantraining.com. So there's J-O-H-N, the letter C, at Aslan, A-S-L-A-N, training.com. Or I'm on LinkedIn, John Cerquera. Last name is C-E-R-Q-U-E-I-R-A. And so, yeah, anybody that has any inquiries on what business related or life related or otherwise, you know, happy to engage in those conversations.
Because you do some speaking on this, don't you?
I do. Yeah. I do some speaking on this. You know, really the subject matter, the origins are usually founded in the connection of 9/11 and landing in the principle of, you know, we are most fulfilled when we serve others. But depending on the audience, I can adjust the messaging. And so I've spoken at, first responders appreciation events, where we're thanking, you know, EMTs and police officers and firefighters for their efforts. I've spoken to, you know, philanthropic organizations who want to hear the story of 9/11, but also want to feel some connection to how what they're doing on a daily basis in their community is of value. And then in business context, just the idea of how serving others and being fulfilled is really the most productive way to interact with your clients if you're a salesperson, for, you know, interacting with your employees if you're a people manager, or even, gosh, interacting cross-departmentally. You know, salespeople having to interact with accounting or project management and different entities within organizations can oftentimes be at odds. And so just helping people to manage the intricacies of just human interaction and being other-centered are usually applications for our speaking.
And I can attest to it. You are a great speaker. You're a great facilitator.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Likewise. Like that's a huge compliment coming from you, because you know what you are. You know how good you are, and so that's quite an honor. Thank you.
No, I mean it. You're really great at it. I've seen you where, you know, you had some. You probably remember the client I'm thinking about. You had some people in the room who seriously didn't want to be there. And you got everybody excited and they were on the same page. And I was thinking, I'm so glad I had the other class.
I remember that. Yep.
So John, this has been absolutely fabulous. Any final words of wisdom?
Be good to others. Be good to yourself. You have no idea what other people are going through. And so, you know, just practice and remember kindness is just my parting shot.
Yeah. That's good advice, right? Nice and simple and powerful. So thank you again.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I hope you loved that interview as much as I loved conducting it. I hope that you found a lot of great takeaways and also inspiration in John's story. I took so much from the interview. In an attempt to keep my takeaways shorter than the actual interview, I've narrowed it down to the following. 1, when you're navigating adversity, you have to have faith. You have to have faith that you won't be in the stairwell forever. It's temporary. Find a way to move forward. 2, when facing a crisis, find frameworks that work for you and that will help you move forward. Frameworks help us to make sense out of the chaos. 3, when facing grief, it is okay and even healthy to feel the unpleasantness without judging it. It simply exists. And here I take a broad view on grief. Grief can happen when we lose a loved one, when a major change throws us off the course that we thought we wanted to be on, when we lose a job, or just when times feel dark and scary. we have this tendency to want to skip past that unpleasant emotions. But two problems with that. Number one, it simply doesn't work that way. Whatever emotion we resist will persist. And number two, there are no good or bad emotions. They simply are. Emotions are simply data points, and it comes down to how we manifest them in our behavior. Related to this point, and something that I just have to address, is something that I hear all the time. People will say something like, and you've probably said this yourself, but people say something like, you know, my situation, you know, yeah, it's bad, but it isn't as bad as someone else's. And that may very well be true, but it doesn't mean that it is any less trying or difficult for you. A couple of years ago, I was on the road for work, and I woke up in the hotel in the middle of the night, and I walked straight into the edge of the bedpost, and I broke my toe. I heard it snap. I will never, ever, ever forget that noise. It was terrible. After curbing my initial urge to scream at the top of my lungs because of the pain, and I thought I shouldn't do that because probably the other guests wouldn't like that very much and I'd probably end up with security called on me, my first thought was, well, hey, at least you didn't break your leg. Okay, true. It could have been worse, right? I could have broken my leg. I could have fallen down and hit my head. It could have been worse. But that didn't mean that it didn't hurt. It hurt. It hurt a lot. It also didn't mean that it didn't swell up so bad that I couldn't get a shoe on. When we seek the angle of it could be worse because we're trying to put things in perspective or find some gratitude for what we do have, that's healthy. However, when we take it to the point where we judge ourselves for feeling bad about the way we're feeling, that's counterproductive. We can feel good that we didn't break our leg, and we still need to take care of the broken toe. Back to my takeaways. Number four, we cannot pour from an empty cup. We have to have the courage to take care of ourselves, especially in times of challenge. And number five, when things shift, we need to look at how do I operate within this new structure? Where can I serve? These are just my takeaways. I'd love to hear from you what you found most beneficial by leaving a comment below. If you found this podcast helpful, please consider subscribing as well as leaving us a 5-star review below. If you know someone who could benefit from the podcast and the message that we are spreading, please tell them about it. Again, this has been the Unyielded Podcast, and I believe that thriving isn't a destination. It is a process, an evolution where we are continuing to expand who we are. It's how we grow into who we were meant to be and how we become our very best selves. And I also believe it's how we make the world a better place as well. My life's work is to change the world for the better, one life at a time. I hope that you'll help me do that by sharing the word.